When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Almost the entire Republican Party indicted yesterday as Fannie Willis indicted Trump. And 18 others, but there were 30 unnamed co-conspirators, and that's where the fun begins. Look, for me, the fun is it's kind of a guessing game. Who are these other 30? I still think Lindsey Graham is going to be on that list, or so I hope. In fact, I saw he could rank as high as number 20. So I'm looking forward to that. Now, again, you know, I don't know that there was a lot of surprise in this. I think the fact that it's such a wide net that she has cast, because understand the differences between what the DOJ did, Jack Smith and the DOJ did, and what Fannie Willis and the folks in Fulton County are doing, completely different. The feds went for something narrow, simple, something they could get through quickly, something they could move on and actually hold someone accountable for. It seems like she wants to get to the bottom of it, wants to hold everyone accountable. Now, understand, the 30 unnamed co-conspirators, those are the rats. Those are the ones who are going to be jumping ship really quick. And I expect even some of the named ones to CYOA to start jumping and going, especially the lawyers. Lawyers don't like going to jail, especially the lawyers who aren't going to get paid, by the way. I fully expect that. Now, I find it interesting that they use the RICO laws, which I was saying, you know, it seems like a criminal conspiracy, seems like a mob kind of organization. What I find interesting, one of the named conspirators, one of the indicted, Rudy, it's weird. This is the weird thing for me, because Rudy made his name using the RICO Act against the mob. You know, Rudy was the mob buster for a while and used that. You would think he would know. You would think that he would know, being part of that whole big thing, that it could be used against him. Now, again, the RICO law is much broader, much more all-encompassing than the federal laws. So, gonna be. No, this isn't gonna happen anytime soon. This is gonna be a couple of years, I think. But gonna be interesting to see how this eventually finishes up, and if we can wrap this up into a full story. I want to know who funded it. I want to know who riled the people up. I want to know who there's so much here. So much. Now, the other part of this is kind of where it has to be on the state level, because states run elections. And I think that's a big part of why you didn't see the feds jump into the middle of that, because in our country, the election laws are state laws. So these are state laws. What's interesting, what I keep seeing is Mark Meadows, who is a named conspirator, indicted one of the 18. He's trying to get it moved to federal court. Trump is going to want to get it moved to federal court. They want to get it out of the hands of the state courts because, well, they think they got a better chance with people that maybe Trump might have appointed. I think that's kind of it. Now, for me, the state charge is important. Because regardless of what happens in 2024, if Trump somehow pulls off a victory and becomes president again, not something he can pardon himself for. And Georgia has a weird little thing where governors don't have pardon power. They've got limited. They can make suggestions, I guess. But so he can't get himself out of this. This could be the one that ends up. And I've had a lot of friends going, this is the one that's going to get him locked up. Now, I'm not that certain. We'll see. Again, this is a huge case. And as has been explained to me already, when Willis has done this in the past, has, you know, cast this wide net, what happens is the rats start to jump ship. And I think that's kind of the hope of these 30 unindicted co-conspirators, that they're going to go, hey, I don't have the money to fight this. I don't have the energy, the time. I don't have the ability to fight this. I'm just going to tell the truth. I'm going to come forth and I'm going to point the finger where it belongs, at Trump and the others. So going to be fun, interesting. But Rudy Giuliani right there at the top, he was one. John Eastman, you may remember, Eastman's the guy who, I guess he dreamt up the whole scheme and, you know, put pressure on Pence and did a bunch of that stuff. So Eastman's big part of this, getting his law license taken away. Mark Meadows was one of them. This guy Cheeseborough, who drafted the memo to bring the fake electors along. So this is a multi-pronged kind of, you know, everyone's got a bad idea. And then there's Jeffrey Clark, who was supposed to be, what was it, acting attorney general. They were going to try, my congressman, Scott Perry, pushed him to the forefront here. Jenna Ellis, who, you know, evidently was Rudy's, you know, lapdog, also wrote some memos so that Pence, you know, might block, you know, the election. What's interesting, the rumor going around right now about Jenna Ellis, evidently she must have said something nice about DeSantis. So evidently Trump's PACs aren't going to pay any of her legal bills. So she's going to be on her own because she said something nice about DeSantis. And this is one of those weird things for me as I'm watching this play out. The thing that's amazing to me is the loyalty that people have to Trump, knowing that if they slip up just a little bit, if they say something nice about somebody that offends dear leader, they're out. They're on an island. They're you're fired. And with it comes all of the headaches and all of the problems of massive legal bills. And I remember saying this for a while, going, you know, his past, his record is that of stiffing people who, I guess, were his friends. And now we're seeing that, you know, as we've known all along, he stiffs everybody. The story broke today that Giuliani, his most loyal henchman, evidently not going to get paid because evidently they had a handshake agreement. And, nothing. Now, are you surprised by it? And the answer should be no. And this is why I think at some point people are going to start turning and quickly. And when it happens, when the door opens and the floodgates go, it's going to be huge. Because all of these people, these lawyers, Sidney Powell, who was all in, she's been indicted. All of the people who were the fake electors, you know, they're indicted now. Which I don't understand why they weren't indicted right from the beginning, but this is all part of this. And I'm hoping this is all televised. I'm hoping it's all right out in front, transparent. Now, I do have a problem with the Fulton County Clerk of Courts because you made me stay up till midnight to get this stuff when you actually did post it on your website earlier in the day. I'm miffed about that. Got to be honest. You could have just said, yeah, made a mistake. It was there. That's it. But no, made me stay up till midnight to find it. Now, fun, something to look forward to on Monday. Coming soon, Trump says he's going to hold a major, major news conference. And this major news conference can be held at Bedminster in New Jersey at his golf course, you know, where his ex-wife is buried. And reports they're not tending to the gravesite very well. And are you surprised? I'm not even a little bit. But evidently, there's going to be a report. And this report is going to, well, I'm going to use his words. He truthed out today a large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable report on the presidential election fraud, which took place in Georgia, is almost complete and will be presented by me at a major news conference at 11 a.m. on Monday of next week in Bedminster, New Jersey, based on the results of this conclusive report. All charges should be dropped against me and others. There will be a complete exoneration. Capital letters. They never went after those rigged the election. They only went after those who fought to find the riggers. The riggers. And the thing is, we know who the riggers were. Brad Raffensperger, one of the riggers. Brian Kemp, one of the riggers. One of the people who threw people off voting rolls. I mean, we know the game. You can go back to 2004, J. Kenneth Blackwell in Ohio. We're only going to take registrations on 80-pound paper, and all the rest of them we're going to chuck. All of these barriers that Republicans have put in the way of people voting, I think we know who the riggers are. So we're going to get this big report. Now, here's the weird thing. Some enterprising reporter checked to see if Bedminster was going to be open on Monday. Turns out the golf club will be closed. They're holding a private event, not the big press conference. So you got to wonder, is this one of those things where he got a little news, in the cycle, and then, well, you just can't have the big report. Yeah. I would not be surprised. Now, here's the thing, and this is what bothers me. All of this talk, in all seriousness, is getting the dim riled up. My email box full of people very angry, and it's one of those things you're going, have you not been paying attention? Did you not know this was coming? This is the fourth indictment. He's hit for the cycle already. It's not the hat trick anymore. He's hit for the cycle. He's got all of them. And now you've got the whispers of violence coming, because along with the indictment, I guess they released the name of the grand jurors, which there is some chatter on 4chan where the lunatics hang out, that evidently the list of names of jurors of the grand jurors, that's a hit list evidently, and they're about ready to go Turner Diaries on them. That's a threat, so you know. That means they're gonna, yeah, you know what they're gonna do. And the thing that gets me is the right will say, no, just like on January 6th, it was a peaceful day. It was a family day. It was a big picnic. It was a party. People were between the ropes. But if you paid attention to their social media, to the 4chans, to the Parler comments, to all of that stuff, the violent rhetoric was ramped up. The heated rhetoric was really ramped up. And that's going to happen as these indictments turn into trials and the more we find out, because that's the only way they're going to keep us, really the only way they're going to keep us from getting the truth is if they can shut it down. Just like the only way they were going to keep Trump in office is if they were to be able to stop Pence from certifying the election, which is what January 6th was all about. It wasn't about, a day of patriotism. Nonsense. They knew why they were there. Every person who went to that rally knew that they were there to stop Pence from certifying the election. Some didn't say, we were just going to protest. But some went there with the idea of any means necessary. And that's the position that sadly we're in. Now, look, here's the thing. This is the thing that blows my, that makes me just furious. I would rather be talking about anything other than Trump. There are so many other things we need to be focused on. But here's the reality. Our democracy is under attack. The threat of losing this wonderful experiment of self-governance is under attack. And this guy is at the center of it. So until he is tried in open court for everyone to see and held accountable, I don't see a way forward. This is the issue of our day. And for those who want them to put it this way, we are living history. Which side will you be on? That's my question. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Got the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, again, like I said, I would rather be talking about anything other than Donald Trump and the attacks on democracy that are happening right in front of us. Like, for instance, the attack on public education. We are seeing it all across the country, from book bans to, you know, to just, well, you know, Schoolhouse Rock for Nazis. The kind of craziness that is happening around our public schools is a couple fold. One, to get everybody riled up and angry so that we polarize each other, and then to destroy public education and to privatize it. And Florida is at the heart of it, much like Pennsylvania with the charter schools and the cyber charters. But evidently they have this step up program. And I was reading through this article on this step up program and how basically, thanks to tax dollars, they are saving Catholic schools. Religious schools are getting huge amounts of money, which is why these things are being pushed. It's about breaking up the teachers' unions. It's about you know, taking what we used to do for ourselves away, and privatizing it, especially into their churches. And this article goes through how basically the money that they're throwing into this is seriously propping up these schools to where now the enrollment is through the roof. But what I found interesting is one of the nuns that was quoted in this talked about the enrollment at this one school. And they said that they had, you know, the enrollment right around 900 is the constant. And what she said was, is that over the last year, the scholarship money, the payoff, the sweetener from the state, grew from 160 people getting it last year to over 560. Now, as I've been saying for the longest time, the reality is this money is going to people who are already sending their kids to private schools. It's just lining their pockets. And I found it interesting that she just came right out and said it. Yeah, you know, we had 160 people last year who were getting the money. Now 560. And it's just a windfall for them, to be quite frank. And we know that. Now, here's the other part of this. The very people who are pushing for religious education and all of this, you know, who want us to, you know, you got to read the book, got to know about the book, are supporting a party that wants to completely ban universal free school lunch programs. It's part of the Republican Study Committee's proposal that in 2024, that's part of what they're going to run on, banning school lunch programs like this. And you go, didn't I know something about feeding the hungry? Wasn't there something in that book that maybe the religious, and here's the thing, maybe this could be the positive. Let me spin this positively. Maybe by government money funding religious education, maybe we'll get better Christians. Maybe you'll get better people out of this. Maybe people will be a little bit better and actually read the book. Maybe, I don't know. I doubt it, but you never know. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, what's on your mind?
Couple of things. Number one, I love the fact that, again, Trump's indicted. And I see Mark Meadows, ooh, and all the little squiggly, slimy attorneys of his. Oh, joy. Let's see what happens.
You mean the ones he didn't
pay? By the way, Gordon.
I got to tell you, if I'm him, I got to be worried. All the lawyers he stiffed over his career, you got to think some of them are going to turn on him.
That's true. Gordon Crone, if you remember her from Twitter, she did say that she wanted to remind everybody that, told you this was going to happen. I don't know. She has her ways. And then the second thing that I wanted to get to talk about was, you know, they wanted to fund the public education because we no longer are indoctrinating them with the right-wing agenda. We're not pushing the religion. If you have the private schools, especially the religious schools, you can push the right-wing Christianity, and then you can also control what they learn, what they read. And when you do that, then you basically keep people ignorant. You know, this is what they did back in the Middle Ages, you know, right after original Christian church, Catholic Church, took over in the second century, which led to the downfall of Rome. This is what they did, you know, they started narrowing down what you could learn, and then all of a sudden they, you know, they came up with, well, nobody's allowed to read the Bible, and if we catch you reading the Bible, then you're going to be considered a heretic and burnt because we don't want you to know what it's saying. So I think they're just trying to take us back to the early 3rd century or 4th century. You know, I was stuck there on the Middle Ages for a while, but I think now they're going backwards.
We're regressing even further. I appreciate the thoughts.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Have
Alice.
A good evening, Rick. Yeah.
And that's the scary part in all this. I mean, the you can take this to a whole bunch of places. But here's the reality in this. You know, the fact that they are pushing their religion without actually pushing what their religion says. I mean, I look at the Republican parties, the Republican study committees, you know, plans for 2024, ending school lunch programs, universal lunch programs. And there are a number of states across this country who have already done it. I mean, look at California, Colorado, Maine, Minnesota, New Mexico, Vermont, I guess, is on the move. There are another 21 states that are talking about doing some form or another. And they're going to try and use the federal government. Again, remember, these are the people who told us they believe in smaller, less intrusive government. They believe in states' rights. These are people who want to use the federal government as a bludgeon over top of all of this. And this is part of this weird kind of I'm not even going to call it religion or faith. I'm going to call it, you know, indoctrination. Especially when you start talking about all the other things that they want to do away with. You know, gutting Social Security and, you know, enriching the very wealthy, gutting Medicare, you know, all of the things that you just think are upside down. And we're in this weird, really alternative reality with the people who brought us alternative facts. The question is when do we, and is this trial that's coming up, will these trials expose this? You know, will people see Trump in his element, and will we take what's being presented? Now, I guess it depends on which hat you wear, if it's the red hat or the blue hat. But for me, I've always said I will believe what's put into those courtrooms, into those court documents. When you put your hand on that book and say you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Under the threat of perjury, that's when it's real. All of the allegations and all of the stuff you see on the F channel and all of the social media stuff is all just noise. We are going to start seeing stuff under oath. And lawyers who know what that means. So I'm telling you, I think a big part of what we're going to start seeing, a lot of rats jumping ship. And the Republican Party trying to save itself. Because right now, they're all indicted. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we come upon the one-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act, one of the things, the positive, is there are green energy projects all over the place. And I've had conversations with people over the last couple of years of going, well, you know, there's a transition period and it's going to take too long. And there's always an excuse to not do it. But I look at how fast we're ramping this up with just a little bit of investment. I mean, if we as a nation really decided, you know, I saw Oppenheimer the other day, and it's one of these things, if we had that kind of mobilization where it doesn't matter, you want a town, we'll build you a town. If we had that kind of commitment, we could flip this in months, maybe early years instead of decades. But here to share some thoughts on the projects that are being built and what the Inflation Reduction Act has done to help us move in that direction, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you as always, sir.
You know, I go back to this and I've had these conversations. Well, you know, it's going to take too long to transition and, you know, we got to do this slowly and incrementally. I'm like, I don't know. I think we've got to buy in and we've got to move in that direction. If you want to get off of dirty fossil fuel and off of stuff from, you know, from people that we don't like us very much, maybe domestic production for domestic consumption is the way forward.
Yeah. Yeah. You're onto something there. And I'm glad you raised up Oppenheimer, because it is, you know, when we, and obviously the outcome of that was, detonating a nuclear device to beat an opponent. But my general point is this: when we put our minds to something and when we invest in it, we can do extraordinary things in a short amount of time. I think about the Sputnik moment, right? When all of a sudden, you know, more than a generation ago, like the Soviets beat us to space. We got to do something. And we not only caught up, we surpassed them with breathtaking speed. And, you know, we built up the arsenal of democracy that way, you know, obviously developed that weapon of mass destruction that Oppenheimer and his crew were doing. But we've done amazing things when we've had the will and we've had the way. So it's not a surprise to me that we have seen a lot of this clean energy scale up take place really, really rapidly. And it's not only the Teslas you see on the coasts, but when I was doing this cross-country trip, I saw a lot of F-150 Lightning pickup trucks in the Midwest that are fully electric, and I was pretty blown away. And I saw a lot of wind power for utilities. I saw a lot of solar farms for utilities, and you know, some of this is invisible to people because it's like they're probably, the odds are that wherever you are in the United States, you might be getting at least 25%, if not more, of your energy right now, the electricity coming to your home from renewable sources. You don't even know it, but it's there. And so it is happening, and it is happening thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, the tax credits, the incentives, the investment in all of that. And this is where, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, but this is like, you know, for I think Democrats, they had the Sputnik moment about climate, and they're like, we're in an existential crisis. We got to do something for all the reasons you indicated and many others. So let's get this done. And, you know, they somehow finagled it with Joe Manchin, which is not easy to do, and got something over the finish line without a single Republican. And it is having a breathtaking impact. I mean, just the clean energy manufacturing tax credits alone are, oversubscribed by what the estimate was by a factor of three. They're triple already what they thought would be. And this is just the early adaption, the pioneers. This isn't even the widespread scaling yet. It is really breathtaking in scope, Brett.
Right. And we had talked about, you know, the fact that China is, you know, so far ahead of us in these investments already. And the thing that blows my mind, and, you know, we're probably about the same age. I remember as a kid, you know, when Carter was president, put solar panels on the White House. And I remember during that period, you know, being a kid going, you know, the future could be, you know, this green stuff. We could solar panels everywhere. I mean, we could do so many great things. And then you had Reagan come in and destroy all that. And it's been all these years later that we're finally getting back to where we should have been in 1980, 1981. We're now basically starting over. But what's exciting to me is there seems to be a commitment to it. And it seems like regardless of what Republicans are doing, we're going in that direction.
Yeah. It is, and the economics favor it now. I mean, in part because of this investment, but in part because of the scale, and in part just because of American innovation, can now generate, you know, wind power, solar panel, or solar power at a cheaper rate per kilowatt than we can with respect to coal or natural gas or nuclear. And so it's cost effective as well because it is renewable, right? I mean, it's like it is not a scarce resource, the wind or the sun, so which is awesome. Okay, so I think that is one thing. And the other thing, and I think this is also very important, is that you point this out, we have had to play catch up. I mean, the thing that really aggravates me is that we invented these technologies. I mean, we invented them. And some of them were federally funded in those federal labs that have done extraordinary things. And then we like literally gave away the keys to the rest of the world. And so China scaled much faster, European Union scaled much faster, and we've had to claw the manufacturing back. And it has been a slog. I mean, and every time we do something, the Europeans are like, well, you're discriminating against it. The Chinese are like, well, you're the biggest threat to the world trade system. And Republicans are saying, well, there's subsidies for this, ignoring the fact that they support them for oil and gas, by the way. But there, you faced all of these obstacles. Yeah. We're saying the quiet part out loud here. But they, you know, despite all of this, there's been remarkable success to the point that even the Republicans, well, all of them, who voted against the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, they sometimes show up at these ribbon cuttings for the solar factory.
It's amazing how that happens.
Or the wind turbine factory. And they're super proud of that. And you know, people are taking those jobs in red states, purple states, blue state, every state.
Yeah, this is one of my problems. This is why I say Joe Biden's a much better person than I am, because, you know, mentally, I'm more in the line with, if you didn't support me, you don't support this. If you vote for people who voted against it, you shouldn't get any of it. Because I know that's selfish of me, but it just seems like you didn't want it. You didn't vote for it. You said no. Right. You shouldn't benefit from it.
Yeah. I hear that. There will be a benefit to all of us from this. I think that's important to understand. I get your point. And I know that there was an analysis done that about 60% of the money for the clean energy manufacturing projects that have been distributed are going to Republican states. When you look at the manufacturing footprint of the United States, I would say that's not super surprising. It's politically awkward,
right?
To your point, Rick. But I do think that ultimately, one of the things that this does, two things. Number one, Republicans who say, or their supporters who are watching Fox or whatever, who are saying, "Well, this is the government controlling the energy sector." Well, actually, if it was the government controlling it, to your point, they'd probably put it all in Democratic states. They're not. You know, it's the private sector that's making these decisions. And then number two, I do think that the more this is scaled up, the harder it's going to be for Republicans to try to eviscerate the Inflation Reduction Act and those components of it. Now, some may try, but it's going to be, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene, as kind of crazy as she is, you know, she had a big solar panel company come to her district, showed up, all of that. So she's going to vote against that tax credit now for a place that's going to employ like 3,000 or 4,000 of her constituents. I find that really hard to believe.
No, I'm with you. But, you know, the thing that is, you know, I we've got solar panels on our house. And I've had a number of people over the years go, you know, how do you like them? You know, where the, and I said, they're great. You know, I mean, the reality is we produce about half of our electricity through these panels. And it was government incentives that helped us do that.
That's right.
The Sunshine Act here in Pennsylvania. And during the Obama years, there was some money to do this. So it made it affordable for us to do it. And it's, I'm shocked not everyone does, because it's not anything we have to jump over hurdles or do anything for. It's just using space we weren't using anyway to produce electricity that we need. It just seems like common sense. Even if you don't buy climate change, even if you don't care about, you know, fossil, it just seems to make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure does. And even given, I mean, you know, who over the last 5 years hasn't been part of a storm where you lost power for a considerable amount of time? Well, and if you have solar and battery backup, you're not going to have that issue about losing power, basically. I think that's something that's important to understand. And the federal government, Rick, is doing everything it possibly can now to provide that consumer incentive to reduce the cost of manufacturing those panels, bring them to the United States. So there are a lot of jobs that are coming along with this. And unfortunately, it's now some state governments where oil and gas and, you know, Republicans who are zealously against some of this stuff try to put up these obstacles for residential solar panels. And so, but again, I think they're going to come down, and we're still, I mean, the thing that excites me is the growth curve for all of this has been way up.
Yeah.
Including, by the way, the manufacturing jobs. And we're just at the very beginning of this.
If we could catch up to China, because we showed this graph, I think a couple weeks ago, where, I mean, they're just like, you know, 4 or 5 times ahead of us.
The
amount of, you know, of capacity that they've built. If we could catch up, the jobs that we could create, the dirty stuff we wouldn't have to use. There are just so many positives. And also, if we could reclaim that manufacturing, we don't have to be dependent on China. Because I don't know if you've noticed, Scott, but China's got some problems.
Oh, they have. They have a few problems. I mean, there's been a series of issues that go back to the pandemic and their handling and Xi Jinping's handling of this. But beyond that, and I think this is the important thing, there have been these structural problems in China for a long time. Basically, people don't trust the government. Surprise, surprise. They can't say that. But the way in which they express that is that they save a ton of money. They don't spend it on stuff. China's economic engine actually depends on like manufacturing, producing stuff. And the world is now sick of what China has been doing for a long time, which is dumping their employment problems. So everybody's wising up to this, and China's, you know, had to try to fire up its growth by investing in real estate with a bunch of deals that make Donald Trump's real estate investments look sophisticated and smart. And so that's going to come back to bite them. And so there are real problems here, but the takeaway for this is not that we don't have to worry about China. The takeaway is we actually have to worry about it more because of the, you know, the desire that Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party is going to have to blame others for their own problems. And so that concerns me. And so I think that we're right in so many different ways to take a hard line on technology getting to China, on China's unfair trade practices, on not trusting China as an economic partner. You know, moving ahead. And so it's anything the Biden administration, Congress are doing on this, they ought to keep on doing it. Yeah. But we got, yeah, there are problems across the Pacific.
I saw Paul Krugman's piece on China. Yeah. And what I found the one part interesting, he said the Biden administration has taken a very hard line on China, much harder in practice than Donald Trump, who talked tough, but mostly flailed around ineffectively. The U.S. government is now promoting semiconductor production to reduce dependence on China, trying to block exports of advanced silicone chips, and most recently banning high-tech investments in China. And you don't, most people don't know that Biden's doing anything because we're not talking about it. Well, the mainstream media is not talking about it because, well, you know, he's just not out there, you know, tweeting and bloviating and patting himself on the back.
Right. That's exactly right. And beyond that, and I know Krugman doesn't necessarily support this, but the tariffs that he's left on China, that Trump put into place, and I'm, you know, I supported the tariffs. I know you did too, and so those are certainly having an impact as well. And so I think that is really, really important. And the difference is, and Krugman's right about this, is that it's a lot more strategic. And it's going to have a much more powerful impact now. And I know Biden's interested in reestablishing contact with China's leaders. And I understand that. But that doesn't mean that we need to backtrack on some of these policies. I think that they have to continue to articulate that, look, you've made your own bet here and we're going to act in our own interests. We're not. You know, we have played this game before and we've given you the benefit of the doubt every time. And that's no longer the case.
Yeah. You're like Lucy in the football, always pulling it away.
I mean, exactly like that.
But here's the thing. And this is where I give Biden credit. Look, he wasn't my first choice, but I think he's doing a great job. He came out the other day and said, look, you know, China's in a bad position. And when bad people are in bad positions, they do bad things. I don't know how much simpler he could put it. And I think that's what the globe is worried about.
Yeah. And so for those reasons, every time people criticize them for trying to talk to China, I think it's very important to do that because Gorbachev and Reagan talked. It didn't make Reagan soft on communism at all for those of us who remember the Cold War. But I think having those lines of communications, but having a tough policy is really important. Yep. And that's the path I hope he continues to
take. Protecting national security by having a manufacturing base, especially in these with these chips and all this. Good, smart policy, sound investment, something I've been calling for years. But Scott, as always, great stuff. I appreciate the time, the input, the expertise. I'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Of course. Can't wait. Thank you so much, Rick, for having me on. Appreciate it.
Outstanding. Our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at the fantastic work they do. Quick break, right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1989. That was the day that Jerry Horgan was killed while walking the picket line. Jerry was a chief steward for the Communication Workers of America Local 1103. The communication workers were on strike against telecom giant NYIAX Corporation, which became part of the present-day Verizon Company. At issue was management's proposal to shift a greater share of the healthcare costs onto the backs of workers. The strike wore on for a total of 17 weeks. In total, nearly 60,000 telephone workers in the Northeast participated in the walkout. These included both CWA members as well as members of the International Brotherhood of of Electrical Workers. Jerry Horgan was part of the strike in the town of Valhalla, New York, about 25 miles north of New York City. Jerry was struck by a vehicle driven by a strikebreaker while walking the picket line. The driver was the daughter of one of the company's managers. She was never charged for hitting Jerry, although some at the scene claimed she accelerated after hitting him with her car. One witness, Charles Pierce, recalled that Jerry was run down like a dog. The CWA honors Jerry's memory by wearing red t-shirts. In 2010, a CWA article titled Why We Wear Red explained, quote, "The idea started small. We asked our members to wear red on Thursday to remind the company of the blood they had spilled and to show support for our fallen brother. But it quickly spread nationwide as a sign of solidarity every Thursday at CWA locations. Jerry Horgan was killed standing up for the rights of workers and fighting for a better tomorrow for all workers." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So President Biden tweeted out, we have to do more, but inflation is down to just over 3%. That is near its lowest point in over 2 years. And look, you know, we're moving in the right direction. I keep saying that. The sad reality is there's a lot of people still struggling. And what Republicans have done effectively is cut off the ability to reach out and help those folks, to have programs to help with homelessness and with hunger. In fact, you know, the attack on school lunch programs is a perfect example of what the GOP is known for, is what they're masterful at. And that is making people struggle, because they know when people are angry, when people are ticked off, they're pliable. That's the part that blows my mind. Now, what we now know is, you know, GDP is forecasting to be tracking about a 5% growth in quarter three. If you, according to reports, if you exclude 2020, their forecast at this stage would have a standard deviation of, you know, 1.5. But their forecast at this stage, unbiased, is up. So all in all, 70% chance of growth between 2.5% and 5.5%. in quarter three, which means that, you know, growth is great. GDP is growing. We're moving in the right direction. Wages have to pick up. What's interesting is I spent, and I'm going to probably talk about this, you know, for the next couple of weeks. I've followed this guy who does these videos from Trump rallies, and they're really informative because he dresses up like a Trump supporter. He's got the hat. He's got the T-shirt. And he goes in and he questions people about what they're angry about. And this is truly, it's what we've been talking about for the longest time. The fact that he gets them to say what's really the problem is incredible to me. For instance, you had these couple of old ladies that he was talking to, and you go, what's the biggest problem? Well, you know, prices are through the roof and wages haven't kept up. He goes, well, should you raise the minimum wage? And they're like, of course we should be raising the minimum wage. And he goes, but Republicans are standing in the way of that. Would you support the Democrats who want to raise it? And they're like, well, and they're now stuck because you've just hit them with reality that Republicans don't want to raise wages, but they've got the costume on. And the weird thing is they feel like they're in a safe space with this guy because he's got the same costume. And they start talking about how, you know, life is a struggle. Wages haven't kept up. Their health care sucks. That, you know, life is hard. And this is where I keep coming back to, where Democrats have to go out and push progressive politics, push the progressive policies that are wildly popular. Even if progressives are not, this is one of those moments where you go, look, the pain, the struggle, the suffering, it's very real. The question is how do you address that? How do you get them to listen? How do you get these people who are struggling
to actually listen and pay attention. That to me is central to all of this. How do we get people to admit what has got them angry, admit what has them riled up, and then address it? Because Republicans are not they're never going to address those problems. When it comes to making lives better for working people, they are never going to help. There's never a moment where you're going to go, a Republican policy made working people's lives better. What's got these folks in is, well, they're angry at the other. They're angry at them. They're angry at whatever the red meat that they've been fed, whatever the outrage candy is that they've been force fed. And again, they're not addressing the core problems. Because when you talk to these people, and this guy's done a great job, I gotta find what his name is, and because we're gonna try and get him on, because I think what he's doing is fantastic. The question keeps coming back to, how do you reach these folks who are truly angry and with cause, and address it in a way that says, how do we unite? How do you get them to take off the red hat? Not necessarily put on the blue hat, but support people who are pushing for policies that are going to make their lives better. You know, it's remarkable to me that working people would not want health care for everyone, especially themselves. It's amazing to me that every working person to say, of course we want higher minimum wage. What are your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I keep coming back to 19 people indicted, Trump and 18 of his Klan members, and 30 unindicted co-conspirators. And I want the names. I eventually want to know, because this could be like a bingo game, if you will. I want Lindsey Graham to be on there somewhere. There's a bunch of people I want to be somewhere on the Scott Perry. My congressman would love to see that, but I know this is a Georgia case. This is here, but this is a wide net that Fannie Willis has cast, and much wider than the DOJ, than Jack Smith and that, which is why I'm going to find it interesting to see where she goes with all this and how many rats actually do jump ship. But here to share some thoughts on the indictment, what it means, and you know, just how big this is. I've asked Aaron Sherb to come talk with us. Aaron's the Senior Director of Legislative Affairs with Common Cause. You can check out their website, commoncause.org. Aaron, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me again, Rick.
So, you know, I'm looking at this. This is a massive indictment. Was it 98 pages? You've got 19 people, you know, named, indicted, 19, 30 unnamed co-conspirators. It's almost like the whole Republican Party's been indicted.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a very comprehensive investigation. Look, this was 2.5 years in the making. You know, hundreds of witnesses, you know, thousands of pages of evidence that were reviewed diligently by career civil servants whose mission is to uncover the truth and to achieve justice. And so, this is a very comprehensive investigation that was undertaken here. And, as you know, this is the fourth indictment for the former president. It's a sad day. It's a tragic day in American democracy when he was indicted. His fourth indictment in this year. He's now been indicted on or faces like 91 different felony counts for an array of crimes across four different jurisdictions. And so it's really a sad day. The first time ever a former president has been indicted this year now. And again, this is the fourth time.
Yeah, but this is unprecedented. I mean, not in my lifetime have I seen the kind of behavior we saw on January 6th. Look, there have always been complaints of, hey, this happened or that happened, but everyone always said, hey, we lost the race. We're gonna come back and we'll fight next time. There's always been that kind of that sense that the rule of law, the tradition of a peaceful transfer of power, that was more important than petty grievances, than self-centeredness until now. And that's why I think this is so important. I think this is a moment in 50-100 years, our great-great-grandchildren are going to look back and go, wow, look how bad they were. And I want to be on the right side of history, I think.
Yeah, look, I mean, the former president is an extreme danger to U.S. democracy, to political norms, and the peaceful transfer of power, and, you know, and the rule of law. You know, look, now he must be treated as any other American would in the legal system. You know, he'll get his day in court and is presumed innocent until, you know, proven guilty by a jury of everyday Americans. But, you know, these are extremely, extremely serious charges here, you know, not only in Georgia, but in the three previous indictments as well.
Now, Trump put out on Truth Social that there is going to be a large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable report on the presidential election fraud, which took place in Georgia. It's almost complete, I guess, and it's going to be presented on Monday. It's conclusive. It's a conclusive report. All charges should be dropped against him and others, and he will be completely exonerated, according to his post. And he wants to go after the real riggers. And I'm going, you know, I look at the real riggers and I look at what Republican legislatures have done across this country with vote suppression and I mean, purging voters and, you know, all of the schemes that they've come up with. We don't talk about any of that stuff. So I'm curious who he sees as the riggers.
Yeah, well, you know, he knows he lost the election. He was already planning this even before the November 2020 election. They were laying the groundwork to try to claim, you know, various conspiracy theories and various, you know, quote unquote voter fraud, which they knew was basically non-existent. So this is a plan in place that they were formulating before the election even happened. And so I think that goes to show that, look, this is all about him holding onto power, him putting himself above the rule of law and thinking that he's, you know, essentially a king or a monarch, and that, you know, the will of the people, the will of the voters just don't really matter. And, you know, the whole the insurrection, the, you know, the attempted coup at the Capitol was just a big attempt to, you know, basically ignore the will of the people, ignore the will of the voters, and trying to, you know, when he called Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, a Republican, lifelong Republican, and told him to find, you know, 11,780 votes, I believe, you know, the Republican Secretary of State stood up for the rule of law and stood up for the you know, the millions of voters in Georgia and said, no, we, you know, Mr. President, we are not ignoring the will of the people. And so I think, you know, this there'll be more details like that come out in an eventual trial for this case in Georgia. But, you know, ultimately it comes down to respecting the will of the people and the voices of the people.
Yeah. So my mind keeps going, of the 49 people who are involved in this, how many of them are jumping ship as we speak? Because, you know, as it's been explained to me, Fannie Willis has used this tactic in the past. And that number, that large number has been dwindled down to a smaller number with all those other people turning state's evidence. Do you expect that to happen here?
Well, I think, you know, certainly, you know, a prosecutor has a certain number of tools at one's disposal to, you know, they're obviously, this is a very comprehensive investigation. This just did not occur overnight. They've obtained, you know, thousands of pages of evidence, you know, conducted hundreds of interviews. And so, you know, she and her team have, you know, likely significant information that points, you know, that implicates a number of individuals here. And so I think they'll certainly, you know, it's hard to know their strategy exactly, but I think, you know, we'll see that play out, you know, as the trial date approaches, whenever that might be.
Yeah. I had a lawyer friend say that his concern is that this is so big, that there's so much here that it's easy to get lost in what, you know, what the point is. Do you have any fear in that this is so comprehensive, that this is so big, that you may not be able to whittle this down to get a jury to understand it?
Well, sure. I mean, the former president has a long standing record of trying to delay, of stretching things out, of, you know, making, you know, certain process arguments here. But again, ultimately, it comes down to respecting the will of the people, respecting the will of the voters, and, you know, making sure that their voices were heard and are heard going forward, and that something like January 6th can never happen again. And so I think, you know, ultimately this is, you know, about the rule of law and accountability. And we have a judicial system in place as imperfect as it is in times. But, you know, there's a legal process in place and, you know, justice is being carried out here right before our very eyes.
Yeah. Well, as they say, the wheels of justice, you know, churn slowly. And here we are seeing them turn very slowly. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Aaron Sherb. He's Senior Director of Legislative Affairs at Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. And talking about the wheels turning slowly, you know, I, you know, for you know, almost the second I heard about the fake electors, I'm like, why aren't they locked up? Why haven't we tried them? I know Dana Nessel, the attorney general in Michigan, has charged their fake electors. Now you're seeing these fake electors. I'm still curious why the day they handed in their homework, someone didn't go, wait a minute, this is wrong. Arrest those people. But here we are, finally someone looking at these fake electors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, justice sometimes takes a long time to achieve. And, you know, our legal process, you know, it takes a while to, again, to gather evidence, to conduct interviews, to do research, to find information. You know, a lot of these people didn't necessarily weren't forthright in handing over information immediately when they were asked for it. So, you know, there's a subpoena, you know, subpoenas take time. And so I think, you know, it's important to get this right, to get the details of this investigation right. And again, it's, you know, sometimes there are inefficiencies in our legal system, but ultimately I think, you know, the, justice will be served here and, you know, the former president will be ultimately held accountable for his actions.
Any chance this gets moved to federal court?
You know, hard to tell. You know, you probably saw, you know, the former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, you know, requested his trial at least be moved to federal court and tried to, in order to try to dismiss that. But, you know, hard to know exactly.
The reason I bring that up is, you know, what's the difference then? You know, explain the difference between, you know, doing this in a state court or a federal court. I mean, it's the same prosecutor, same charges. What would be different?
Well, I think, I mean, there are a couple, you know, so one of the charges that the former president faces is under a RICO Act or, you know, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. It's a state law. You know, the former president, you know, if he becomes president again or a future president could not pardon him for, you know, under that state law. You know, I think, you know, so that's kind of one angle or one dynamic. I think also, you know, the former president thinks that ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court, if something eventually gets up to there, I think, you know, since he appointed three members of the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, I think he thinks that they will somehow be more favorable to him in the end. And I think, you know, given the number of federal judges that he appointed to the court, I think he, you know, somehow expects or demands a certain loyalty for them, from them. So I think that's part of the calculus, at least for trying to switch this to a federal court.
Yeah. Anything in this indictment that surprised you? Anything that caught your attention? Because there's been a lot of talk about what was going to happen. I think a lot of people knew the RICO thing was going to be the direction they went. Anything surprise you?
Well, I think just the number of co-conspirators, both named and unnamed, in here. You know, like you, I'm very curious about those, all these other ones who are unnamed in there. Obviously, this was not just a one act show. There were many people who were involved in, you know, scheming, conniving, you know, developing these, you know, conspiracy theories to try to overturn the election and overturn the will of the people. So I think, you know, there's certainly a lot more people who could be implicated here. So I think those names will, you know, potentially come out as the trial approaches.
Now, on the democracy front, and I know Common Cause is an organization that fights vehemently to maintain our democracy and voting rights and all of this. You know, why is this important? You know, why? Because I have a whole bunch of my Trump supporter friends say, well, you know, this is a political witch hunt. You've heard all of it. But their bottom line is, you know, we don't really need to do this. It wasn't a big deal. We should just let sleeping dogs lie. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, Trump was unsuccessful in his attempted insurrection and coup in 2020, 2021. You know, he's learning things. You know, they're next time they're learning things, they may try it again. And so, you know, if there aren't penalties, if there isn't accountability for the bad actors last time, somebody else is going to do it again. If not Donald Trump, somebody else in some party, you know, down the road. So they have to be held accountable. They have to be punished for the attempt to overturn the will of the people, or else it's going to green light some other future insurrection.
No, I mean, it's an excellent answer. But the other part of this is my concern is someone a lot smarter, someone a lot more tactical, a little more strategic, someone, you know, not as blatant, not as outward, not as open, may try this in the future and actually get away with it. Someone, because I got to tell you, I think, you know, someone who wasn't as you know, extreme as Trump, I don't know. You know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, look, he's creating a playbook. We're in completely uncharted territory here. And so, you know, like you said, you know, somebody smarter, more devious, you know, who's had experience in government before, you know, who, you know, can marshal the resources to try to pull something off, like this off again. Yeah, totally worry about that. as well.
Yeah, but here's the thing. One of the defense arguments that I'm seeing, and maybe you've seen it too, is, well, he didn't know. He didn't know any better. You know, he's just listening to advice of counsel. Do you think that holds water at all, given the fact that he ran a campaign on lock her up and, yeah, and all of the stuff that he had done? Does that hold any water?
I mean, that's rubbish. I mean, you know, there are documents, you know, saying that they, you know, their communications that they were planning this before the, you know, in, I think several months before the 2020 election, that they were already planning to like lay the groundwork by invoking, you know, quote unquote voter fraud. And so, you know, this is, you know, fed into the big lie. And so they were kind of laying the groundwork for this, you know, months before the election even occurred. So I think, you know, who's to say they won't try that again or aren't already trying to do that again for, you know, for November 2024, if he, again, is the nominee next year.
No. So, you know, here's the last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, again, I paid attention to, you know, what was being said on January 5th. You know, I was watching Parler. I was, you know, seeing some of the 4chan comments. There was a lot of violent talk. We're starting to see that happen again. In fact, you know, it was just reported that, you know, on 4chan, they're talking about the grand jury as a, you know, the names that were released as a hit list. And they're going to go all Turner Diaries on them and all this. Are you concerned about the potential violence of the kind of heated rhetoric and the kind of accusations you see from Trump and his supporters?
Absolutely. I mean, we see that across all sorts of social media platforms, and, you know, Common Cause has an extensive anti-misinformation and disinformation, you know, attempt to try to flag, you know, not only violent posts, but also, you know, telling voters to vote at an incorrect location or, you know, trying to, you know, get them to vote on a different day than the actual election day. So we have an extensive, you know, network to try to push back against some of those things. But, you know, to your point, you know, absolutely, you know, violence, you know, trying to invoke or, you know, call his supporters to violence if he doesn't get the outcome he likes is of course, an outcome that we have to be very wary of. And, you know, hopefully, you know, I think this time, you know, certain law enforcement agencies were caught off guard. I think, you know, this next time, hopefully, I think, you know, people will be fully prepared in a way that everybody wasn't fully understanding for January 6th.
I sure hope so. I sure hope you're right. But it's going to be an interesting couple of months, maybe even a couple of years watching this. And hopefully it will be live on television and we can all participate. But more importantly, see with our own eyes and hear the testimony that's being played out in a courtroom with people who are sweared in under the penalty of perjury, not on the F channel, not on social media, but actually in a court with the threat of perjury for lying. I think that's important. But Aaron, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues down the road.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
Thanks so much, Aaron Sherb. He is the director, senior director of legislation at the Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, one of the things that's kind of concerning me is, look, you had Parler you know, which wasn't really a big player back in 2021. There were a lot of crazy people on there, and they felt quite emboldened to say all of the hateful, angry, racist kind of stuff that they were doing, make all the threats, and it was a free for all. I now look at the fact that the right has taken over Twitter because Elon Musk bought it so that they could destroy it and turn it into a right-wing free-for-all. Now, understand, this is the weird part about this. You know, Musk keeps saying, well, I bought it because I wanted to promote free speech. I wanted everyone to have a say. And then immediately says, well, you can have more say if you give me money. You give me the 8, 10, 12 bucks a month, whatever it is, and we'll give you a blue check mark, and you'll get 30 times or 35 times more views than a person who just gets it for free. Remember, it was about free speech. Never mind the irony of having to pay for your speech under the guise of free speech. But now you start seeing that people who have done the research on this stuff, that, you know, hate speech is massively increased, use of derogatory terms and what they are, all of those words now, through the roof, of which, look, to be honest, I would prefer you tell me who you are. So go ahead, say whatever you got to say. This way I know who you are. Back in the old days, I had a friend who, old black guy, from Georgia, oddly enough. I was probably in my early 20s. He was in his 60s. And he said, look, I preferred it much better when they would just walk up to me and call me the name that they were thinking instead of smiling to my face and stabbing me in the back. And that stuck with me. I would rather people be open and honest about how horrible they are. And this is where I guess social media has allowed that to happen. I've been saying for the longest time, social media has allowed people to be the worst version of themselves because there's this thin veil of anonymity. Now, sadly, that has transitioned into people are just turning into the worst versions of themselves. But I bring up the Musk thing because, again, free speech. Remember, this was all about free speech. He paid $44 billion for Twitter, turned it into a $20 billion company. Again, it was about it's about free speech. Report today that evidently the company formerly known as Twitter, because it's now X, evidently they've been caught throttling certain websites back. So if you link to the New York Times, for instance, they're throttling that back so that it takes you longer to see it, so that maybe you give up on it, because we're in this instantaneous world. Now, me, if I want to see something, I'll wait for it, or I'll refresh it a couple of times, or I'll look for it somewhere else. If you're throttling me back, I now want to know why. But they understand through their algorithms and through their data collection that most people aren't like that. Most people, if it's a couple of seconds by, screw it, next. Evidently, a lot of news organizations, a lot of the competitors, I guess Facebook is one that they've targeted as well. This is another one of those moments where, be honest about what it is. Musk bought Twitter to destroy it. That was it. And to turn it into a right-wing space. To turn it again into another place that's powerful enough. Because Truth Social, there's nobody there. The Gab, there's nobody there. There's nobody in these right-wing spaces. Because, well, there's no fun in just having an incestuous pool of incels yelling insults at each other. Which is what those other sites are. I have a Truth Social account. I don't think I've ever posted there. Maybe something right at the beginning. I'm here. But I don't spend time on it. I get it so I can look at, some of the craziness. So I can ghost and look at how extreme these people really are. And this is one of those kind of moments where you just, you look at this and you ask yourself, what was the point? Why did he buy Twitter? He bought it to destroy it. for this moment. Because you know what was trending on Twitter today? And it's not even about, you know, small hashtags. You know, it was something like, you know, Trump 2024 must happen right now, or some, you know, sentence on a hashtag. It was about giving Trump cover. And we're going to see an awful lot of you know, just vile, vile stuff. My email box has been filling up with more and more. Because I do think we have to hold him accountable. I do think he has to be beaten at the ballot box. But I do think in the court, not just the court of public opinion, but in an actual courtroom, he does need to be held accountable. If for no other reason than to send a message to future wannabes that we're not going to tolerate it. We're not going to allow it. Just my thoughts. Want to hear yours. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, email me, Rick, at the Rick.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this article over at Freight Waves that grabbed my attention. Because as you know, we've been talking about the UPS Teamsters contract, which has seen really significant increase in wages, air conditioning going to come into the trucks, lots of really good stuff. And I saw this article at Freight Waves that said, hey, a former contractor at FedEx is saying, hey, if you want to compete, you're going to have to up the pay for your drivers. And he's saying at least a 15% bump in compensation. Now, the weird thing is, I just talked to a FedEx driver who was telling me that, you know, they get crummy pay. The conditions are terrible. The vehicles are terrible. But, you know, $49 an hour, I don't even know what I would do with that. Which, again, puts me in this place of, you know, we as working people so undervalue our worth and our labor. And here to share some thoughts on, well, maybe how we get to a place where we start valuing ourselves, and about this contract, which I got to tell you, at this point, I'm not seeing a downside yet. But that's why I've asked Tony Rosario to come talk with us. Tony's an organizer with Teamsters Local 804, their website, teamsterslocal804.org, the website. Tony, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you having me on the show.
So what do you make of this? I mean, you know, you've got a contractor for FedEx going, hey, you know, if you want to keep good people, you want to keep quality people, your contract hasn't even been ratified yet. They're already saying we got to compete. We got to bump wages up. It's already having an effect.
You know, and it's so important. I mean, we took a lot of time in building this campaign out. We're talking about a year's worth of campaigning for this contract, literally 1 year out from the anniversary of the 1997 UPS strike, which I was a young 23 year old, young kid at UPS loading trucks. And actually, you know, at that time I started in 94. So 3 years later was the strike. And I was about a good 22, 23 years old during that strike. And, you know, I say to myself, these are the kind of things that it takes to show these corporations that they have to give us what we deserve. And I love that we were able to get new leadership, you know, and Sean O'Brien and that slate, the Teamsters United slate, they did such a great job of getting the members together, having these practice pickets, also with the coalition, also with Teamsters for Democratic Union, which was just like a marriage made in heaven, just people trying to make a difference. And we did. And I mean, all through this contract campaign, you could feel it, you could see it. All the escalating actions. When we were out there rallying for Martin Luther King Day, rallying to get air conditioning in our vehicles, and then, you know, leading up to the practice pickets over the last few months, I think the company knew that we were serious, that this was a credible strike threat. And it was time for them that they were going to have to pay the drivers what they deserve. And they were going to give us what we were. And we weren't going to just settle for it. We were going to take it. And I believe that's what we did. And I'm very proud of it. It raised the standards for everyone. And that's why you're hearing what you're hearing, Rick, because people know these drivers are going to be making good money. Even the part-time workers inside are making a solid salary. And it's not just the amount of the money they're getting. It's the benefits that come with it. It's the whole package. It's actually having money towards a pension. I can promise you, Amazon workers, no matter what they're paying them, they're not getting good benefits and they're not getting a good pension. So, and when you hear about talking to FedEx workers, same thing. They know what's here on this side of the fence. So, hey, if you're looking to organize and you're tired of what's happening with your company, you know, call the Teamsters. We'll be out there. We're looking to help everybody.
No, I mean, this contract should be that. This contract should be that going, hey, this, you should want this. But you know, if I could just correct one thing, I don't think your members deserve it. I don't think your members deserve the wages they get. I think they earn it. There's a huge difference. You should be demanding what you earn. And I think UPS read the room. We're in a time right now in this country where workers, at least some, are saying, you know what? You called us essential. You called us frontline heroes. You patted us on the back. You gave us all of these wonderful words. How about backing that up with the wealth that we create? And I think they read the room and rightly so came back with a good contract.
Well, and you're absolutely right, Rick. But even with all that, you know, funny enough, contract negotiations broke down quite a few times between our national negotiating committee and the company. You would think that after hearing what you said, you would think that they would have just came to the table knowing this and saying, hey, you know what? You're right. You guys deserve this. But no, it was fighting. They were fighting back and forth, tooth and nail, till we got what we got. I mean, negotiations at around, I believe, July 5th had broken down at 4:15 a.m. It wasn't looking good. I thought we were going to strike. Yeah. I was like, that's it. It's pretty close to the deadline. You know, how much closer can we get? Just a couple of weeks away. And sure enough, a week later, they called up and they, you know, listen, we got a lot out of this contract. I could tell you, Rick, I've been with the company UPS 29 years. I'm a 29-year Teamster. And this is the best contract I've ever seen in my life before my eyes.
No,
you know, and I get that every year we're trying to step to the next level, right, Rick? But I can promise you a couple of years under the Hoff administration, that just wasn't happening. So to see where we're at now, to where we came from, I am super excited about all the work that was put into this contract.
Now, here's the important part. And you know, all the work that you did, all of the internal organizing, this is the kind of stuff that I've been saying for years that unions need to do more of. And I remember when I first started, when I was a young kid, you know, back in the late 80s, starting in the union, I had an old timer explain to me that back in the 50s and 60s, they went on strike every at least 10 years, whether they needed to or not, simply to get people organized, to get people on the same page, to get people to walk across that threshold and know that they were fighting for something. And he said, look, even if you went out for one day, you knew you fought for something and you would never give it up. And for a couple of decades, we've given that mentality up. I think, and I want to get your thought on this, I think we're going back to those days of, hey, we've got to have direct action. We may have to take it to the streets, and because we earn more than we're getting. And at least that's where my thought process is.
I mean, Rick, you're hitting the nail right on the head. I mean, that's exactly where we're at. You could look around, Rick. You could see it. I mean, everybody in this country is tired of the BS. Everybody in all the workers that have been making wealth for all these corporations are just so fed up. And you see it with the uprising and workers at Starbucks. Okay, almost 300 stores or over 300 stores already, you know, fought to have a union, and they still don't have a contract. Like something has to change.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. Obviously, they want a union. We're not talking about 10 or 15 stores here. We're talking over 300 stores, and they still don't have a contract. Amazon as well. Amazon, you have Teamsters and Local 396 out in California that just unionized about 84 workers. You have the big win in Staten Island by ALU and Chris Smalls. And they've had a union for over almost a year now and still have no contract as well. And it's just a game that these big corporations are paying. And it's time for people to see what a union can do. And I thought that this contract was a good, you know, sign of that, what you can fight, what you can win for, as long as you stick together. I mean, if people only knew, Rick, that all we have to do is stand together, shoulder to shoulder against these corporations, and we can win so much from them. Because what you said in the beginning of the show, we create that wealth for them. Without that wealth, they have nothing. And without us making it for them, they have nothing. So all we have to do is threaten sometimes to withhold our labor like we did during this one-year contract campaign. It was just a year-long threat, and we were ready to. It wasn't just an empty threat. We were ready to. They just so happened to give us just about everything we wanted to stop it from happening. Yeah. So that's a good thing. But these other companies, listen, the workers have to start getting together. Even if you don't have a union, act like one. You have protections under the NLRA. You have protections under the LRB. You can have protected concerted activities. You can get together with your coworkers and fight against these bosses. You don't have to be scared. And listen, there's other unions out there trying to be there to help you. So don't be afraid to call on us.
I've never heard a Teamster say there are other unions out there. Good on
That's
you.
That's true.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Tony Rosario. He's an organizer with Teamsters Local 804. You can check out their website, teamsterslocal804.org. If you want to join a union, and I highly suggest the Teamsters being one of the better ones. Let me ask you this, you know, in looking at this contract, which, you know, as I said at the beginning, you got this FedEx contractor saying, hey, we got to bump things up. I got to think Amazon's going to be thinking the same way with their contractors. But the bigger point of this, and I think you hit on it a little bit, is the fact that, you know, we should be able to organize these people. I've talked to Amazon and FedEx drivers. They want to organize. But the problem is, and I think you know this as well as anyone, our laws are so badly broken. And this is where it comes back to the political part of this. You know, I say all the time we need to take off the red hats and the blue hats and put on a hard hat. But I think the only way we reunite this country is by reunionizing. And Amazon and FedEx and these giant corporations, these have got to be the targets that working people come and fight for.
You know, Rick, I couldn't have said it better myself. I love that you said the blue hats, the red hats, and the hard hats, because that's exactly it, right? It's about the hard hats. We're the ones that are working. We're the ones busting our asses. Yeah, I would love for there to be some type of workers' party, 100%, and something real and something strong. But yeah, we have a long way to go. But what I can tell you is that workers are standing together, and that's the important takeaway from this, that you have workers. Last I heard, there was a Waffle House somewhere, and the workers just had like this march on the boss. And like, I'm like, this is insane. Starbucks, Trader Joe's, Chipotle, Amazon, workers are gathering, they're fighting, they're trying to make a difference. And we need to strike while the iron's hot. We cannot let that go. It was a big win for the Teamsters as far as this TA went through. Or when it goes through, but at the end of the day, we still have to vote on it. That's what I love about being a Teamster. It's still a democratic process. There's 340,000 workers, and I can promise you not everyone is happy about it. But at the end of the day, a lot was won. There's some emphasis on the big gains. And listen, and I'm going to be honest, I've been here 29 years, so I'm not going to bullshit you. At the end of the day, we didn't get everything we wanted, but oh my God, we got so much. And that's what we have to keep fighting for, to continue to get more, continue to secure more for our workers. If a company makes $100 billion in revenue, which is what Amazon, which was what UPS is, you know, was looking like at the end of the last few years, they got that revenue of $100 billion. Then, and we secure about $30 billion, Rick, for our workers. That's a big chunk.
Yeah.
That's enough to say, hey, you know, we got them. We want a fair contract. That's what we want. They're the golden goose. We're not trying to kill the golden goose, Rick. It's laying the eggs, you know. And but I think we did a great job of choking that golden goose just a little bit to make sure we got some good eggs to hold on to over the next 5 years, Rick.
No, look, at the end of the day, you do the hard work. You're the ones out there sweating and bleeding and backs aching and bodies broken. This is how it's supposed to be. And I tell this story all the time. I started in the freight business back in the late 80s, and it was the gold standard job at the time. The LTL industry was 85% unionized. Back in those days, we were making right about what you know, in today's dollars, somewhere close to what UPS is getting paid. And over the years, as companies have been put out of business, as deregulation destroyed that industry, the wages have fallen badly. And this is where you keep talking about unions raise wages for all the industry. And I'm glad to see that, you know, in this moment, I think this UPS contract is going to be what buoys this forward in the delivery industry, which is why I think it's so important. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because obviously we've been talking about, you know, Starbucks and Amazon and all these places, the energy that's out there, and you're, as an organizer, you're seeing these people who want what they earn. They want a piece of the pie that they create. What advice do you give to people? So I'm going to let you put your organizer hat on here. And what advice do you give to people, you know, in their workplace? You know, what's that golden nugget, if you will, to get workers activated, engaged, and motivated?
You know what? I'm going to give you that golden nugget. And it for me, it's a lot of times I'm literally talking about how I grew up in this union. I always make it a point to know a little bit about the person, and sometimes to get that person to open up, I may have to let them know a little bit about myself. And I let them know that I was a young kid in 92 when my father had just passed away. And 2 years later, I saw, you know, my mom was doing what she had to do to pay for the mortgage on the house, and I could see she was struggling, and I knew I needed to get a job. And I was lucky enough in 94 to find a good union job, and I was able to help my mom, and it means a lot to me. And I make sure that the people that I'm talking to know that when we're fighting for a union, we're fighting for people that are out there that are just trying to make an honest living. Maybe they couldn't go to college. That's okay. Not everybody can go to college. Not everybody can be a doctor, a lawyer. There's a lot of good trade jobs out there. You can drive a truck and make an honest and good living. You can raise a family. You can get a house, and everybody should be afforded that. And those are some of the things that I go in with. And one thing that I let them know, which is the true golden nugget, Rick, is, listen, I'm here for you and I'm going to support you in any way that I can. But I cannot walk through that fire for you. You have to walk through the fire. I will support you. I will be there. I will give you what you need. I will give you the tools you need to get through it and walk through it. And I will be there on the other end with open arms when you're ready to make it through. But I can't walk it for you. A lot of times these workers think that when you're coming in to save the day, and they have to know that it's on them to do the work. As workers, we have to make sure that we know that we cannot expect other people to come and save us. We have to build that unity within our workforce. It's about building worker power. And once you have that, once you've spoken to enough people and you've built up a good force of folks that are willing to take on the boss, you take those next steps, you put in those petitions, you file those charges, you do what you have to do. And that's all legal. Just make sure you look under the, and when I talk about other unions, I mean it. Listen, the Teamsters are big, the Teamsters are strong, but at the end of the day, even we are not strong enough to take on some of these big major corporations because they have more money than you could imagine. Yeah. And they will do anything, like you mentioned, about dealing with politicians, greasing those palms, making sure they get a lot taken care of for their share, and we get left with the rest that are actually looking to make a difference. And you know what? There's some good ones out there, Rick, but we got to find a few more labor-friendly politicians that are actually going to help push legislation that's going to force these corporations to do certain things. But again, if the people don't have the power to do it, it doesn't matter. You know, I can promise you, being a UPSer for 29 years, as soon as that ink dries on that contract, they're violating. And it takes a strong membership. It takes a strong membership that's going to hold the company accountable, have stewards that are educated and ready to take on the company and make sure they protect the workers, and making sure the workers know that they have rights and powers on their own without being a steward. You know, things that they can do on their own, you have to educate the workforce.
There you go. As I always say, union job, better life. That's the golden nugget. And it's not the union, it's our union. That's the message. But Tony, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great talking with you. Good on you guys with that contract. I look forward to being ratified, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Anytime, Rick. I appreciate it, and thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Tony Rosario, organizer there with Teamsters Local 804. You can check out their website, teamsterslocal804.org. We'll get links out on social media. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That Sunday, President Richard Nixon addressed the nation in a speech that preempted the popular television show Bonanza. His subject, the state of the economy. The speech was timed before the stock markets opened on Monday morning. The president announced a 90-day freeze to wages and prices. He took this step in an effort to curb soaring inflation. Inflation had topped 6% in 1970 and stayed above 4% the following year. The president declared, "The time has come for decisive action. Action that will break the vicious circle of spiraling prices and costs." President Nixon also announced the suspension of tying the U.S. dollar to the gold standard. The policies became known as the Nixon Shock. A cost of living council was established to oversee the plan. Initially, the public embraced the plan. At first, the plan seemed to help curb inflation. Many rank and file workers approved, but leaders from organized labor worried about how the policy would impact contract negotiations. AFL-CIO President George Meany called the plan inequitable, unjust, unfair, and unworkable. Inflation started to rise again. Nixon continued to implement similar measures for a total of nearly 1,000 days. The end result? Inflation had reached double digits by 1974. One of the impacts of these policies were that regular families had a harder time making ends meet. More women entered the workforce. During the 1970s, the dollar lost a third of its value. The Nixon shock shaped the economy of the 1970s and had a long-term negative impact on working families. In the four decades since the plan was implemented, 7 out of 10 workers have not been able to keep up with the cost of living. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, I got to tell you, I like that guy. I like him a lot. You need more people like Tony there to go out and preach the good word. And look, the reality is union job, better life. And I've told this story before. You know, as a kid growing up in a housing project, I never imagined that I would be able to lead the life that I've led. Never imagined that I would own my own home or own a car or let alone 4 or 5. I never imagined the life that job, that union job was able to afford me. And look, you know, the reality is I worked hard. I played by the rules. And because of that contract that fought for good wages, you know, not the kind of wages that kill the golden goose, but the kind of wages that you earn with health security, retirement security. And I know, look, I'm fortunate. I'm going into, you know, the final phase of my working life, knowing that, you know, when I go to retire, there's going to be something there for me because the union fought for it. There's going to be a retirement plan that I'm going to be able to, you know, with dignity, live out the rest of my years. And I want that for everyone. I don't throw that out as go, oh, look how great, look how lucky I am. I'm saying that everyone should be demanding this. And this is where, you know, in talking with Tony about the energy that you saw at UPS, the energy that you see at Starbucks or Waffle House, of people going, look, we demand better. And this is that anger that I was talking about earlier. You know, I was telling you about the guy that who dressed up like a Trump supporter and goes to these Trump rallies and is talking to Trump supporters. And you see these people because they feel comfortable with this guy. He's one of them. He's one of us. So he, you know, he obviously must know. And they feel like nobody's watching so they can be themselves. They're among their own kind. And they're talking about the things that matter to them. And while the kooky stuff is there, all of the Q stuff and all the lunacy is there. But when you get to the core, when you hear them talking about, you know, inflation's hurting us, our wages haven't kept up. Well, you know how you fight back against inflation? you have contracts that have cost of living adjustments so that you don't lose, so that you keep up, so that your standard of living isn't eroded. You have that in your contracts. And I know we've done this. We've done it before. In fact, a lot of contracts still have them. But understand, we're 6.7% of the private sector workforce, a little over 10% of the entire workforce in the country, which means that, you know, 90% of the country is struggling. The working class of this country has been taking it on the chin for far too long. And all they've been fed is on the left is, well, go get an education. Go back to school, get better skills. And on the right, it's, well, you did everything right. You're brilliant. It's those people over there. Be angry at them. And both are wrong. Both sides have gotten it wrong for too long. And look, Democrats have got to take their talking to as well in this. Republicans hate working people. Just look at what they do. But Democrats haven't always been their friends either. And this is where, looking at Joe Biden, I'm going, here's a guy who's trying. Here's a guy who's trying to do what we need him to do. All the Trump bluster around China didn't amount to a hill of beans. We got the guy who can barely get out a sentence who's actually doing something positive. That's what's important. I don't care what you say. I care about what you do. I don't care, you know, I say this all the time about Republicans. I don't care about how pious you are and how religious you are. If you're taking food out of the mouths of children, you're evil. It's the same thing on the other side. You could talk about supporting workers, but it's got to be in your policies. And the fact that this guy was interviewing Trump supporters and they're talking about raising the minimum wage as a way to help, quite remarkable to me. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll get ours. Also, questions, comments, something on your mind, something I got under your skin, something made you think, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.